Right, put that out of the way. All right, well, let me say welcome and thanks for being here today. So fabulous to see all your faces. I miss you all. But look, we'll get cracking because yeah, Steve's got a hard hour here, but we are talking today about selling a business, selling your business, selling our business, whatever that whichever one works for you. Now, Steve Wisner is going to host today's conversation, and he's well placed to do so for three good reasons, actually. One, he offered to do it, so that's always a good place to start. And look, Steve and I met only a few weeks ago. He's a very brand new member to the end-to-end community, so hopefully you'll warmly welcome him. He was introduced to me via Peter Frampton. Many mm-hmm. of you would know Peter. And we had a great conversation for about an hour, Steve and I, and he was very quick to say, what can I do that would be of benefit to the end-to-end community? And, you know, for me, that's the best thing ever. I love it. I love it when people offer to do stuff and to give gifts to others. So yeah, he offered. The second good reason is, you know, prior to being in this L&D space like we are, you know, he spent 20 odd years in investment banking and private equity. So he's got a lot of, you know, corporate experience in that space. And the third good reason, you know, whilst being the founder of Peloton RPM, a communication skills focused training organization, he also recently bought we bought Watershed Associates, which is a negotiation skills company. So he's recently just purchased a training organization. So suffice to say, Steve is in a great position to, you know, host us through this conversation, and it will be a conversation, and we'll all get involved and have a bit of a say and ask questions. So without further ado, Steve, I hand over to you, mate. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. I'm a little nervous. It's kind of weird, actually. I do a lot of communications coaching, but for whatever reason, I get nervous sometimes, especially in this case. It's a new group of people, obviously. And I want to also, I think the reason that my nerves are jangling a little bit is because I want to keep this as non-wonky as possible. That's, I think, a really important part of the conversation here is there's a lot of technical aspects and legal aspects and tax aspects and all these ticky-tack things that are critically important to a transaction. I don't think that's where we should spend our time today in reality, apart from speaking about them at high levels. For me, what I'd really like to get to, I'll go through a couple of things quickly, but what I'd really like to get to is also the personal side of what's involved. Because ultimately, from my perspective, as a business owner, I think about this myself in terms of what's my ultimate plan going to be with RPM and with Watershed. At some point, I would hope to probably sell the companies. And there's a lot that goes into that that the investment bankers aren't going to necessarily speak with you about, and that the private equity firms are not necessarily going to share with you. And it really is what goes on between the ears. And what that means for you personally in terms of the day the deal closes and beyond. And to me, I think that that matters, frankly, in many respects more than a lot of the transaction details. So, but in any event, so let's dive in for a second. Let me share my screen. Give me 1 second. Okay, perfect. So just quick background, as Peter just said, I spent about 20 years in banking and private equity. So I was on both the sell side and the buy side of the business before I started Peloton RPM back in 2012. But I've really been doing training since 2015, 2016. And the opportunity to acquire Watershed is something that kind of popped up earlier last year. And for me, it was an interesting opportunity to put my old deal hat back on, to buy a business that I think is a really great little company. A lot of different reasons that go into my thought process around acquiring a business, but that's not my story today. So let me be crystal clear. I'm no longer in the deal business. I'm not pitching to sell. I'm not pitching to buy. I just want to give you some thoughts and observations that I've seen combining that L&D experience and business owner experience with the transactional side of things as well. And I'm going to go through two slides quickly, and then I'm going to shut it down so we can just have conversation and address any topics that you all want to discuss. The first one I wanted to really focus on is, what are the reasons to sell now? What I really mean by that is, what are the things that might motivate me or any of you to think that maybe this is the right time to do it? Number one, of course, is retirement. It's a simple one. There will come a time for all of us where we decide it's time to turn the page and to focus on what comes next in our lives. And I will say now, interestingly enough, having worked on larger transactions during my finance career and now acquiring Watershed, which is a very small business, for me, the owners of Watershed were really looking to turn the page and move on to their next adventure. One of them wants to paint, so the other one wants to cook. And I will tell you, as a buyer, for me, that has been incredibly fulfilling to help them move on to that stage of their life, to proceed with that journey. And there's a lot of, obviously running these small businesses is incredibly demanding. There will come a time where we realize it's time to move on for whatever reason. And as a result, we have to sell. Another one that we see all the time, and this isn't necessarily the case for anyone on this call, so I won't spend a lot of time on this, but for people who own more physical businesses, relocation, for whatever reason, there's a relative who may have taken ill or a family dynamic at play, someone has to move to the East Coast, whatever it may be. And it really is a face-to-face in-person business. So relocation often can drive the decision. The next one, which I think is relevant to all of us on the call today, is industry slash competition. We might look at the landscape as business owners and say, the earth is shaking under my feet. I say that begrudgingly sitting here in California. I shouldn't taunt fate like this. But the point that I'm making is there's a lot of change that's going on right now in the economy, in the L&D market, in any industry. But I'm sure all of us have probably seen this OpenAI chatbot that came out this week and how that is really making people reimagine their business. It could be a new technology that's in place. It could be that two of your competitors have just merged with one another and are now coming after you. It could be that the economy overall is starting to tip and that price is becoming more of a factor. Being on our own may not be viable anymore. We might be put into a position where we need to combine forces with a larger company in order to remain viable because of those dynamics that are taking place in the industry. And that's another thing that a lot of people will think about. I will give you this example. Coming out of COVID, I think that that prompted a lot of people to think about this as well, because a lot of business dynamics have fundamentally transformed. And in certain cases, those business owners aren't willing or capable of remaining competitive on their own, given those changing industry dynamics. The third piece, money. And I always remember, this is a situation, there's a guy I know who owned a very large business that ended up going public. And he was a founder, he bootstrapped the company for a long time, and he got into a financial pinch at one point. And he needed to sell part of his company, which, by the way, in that case, ended up, he gave up hundreds of millions of dollars of value, quite literally. But there was a financial situation that he needed to deal with. And he loved the business. He was passionate about the business. He believed in the business. But this situation prompted him to have to raise liquidity and have to do a deal that otherwise he wouldn't have wanted to do. But sometimes money just prevails and you've got to take that plunge. Personal. And this is the first step towards the broader conversation, which is, this is a hard life. This is challenging. It can be lonely. It can be isolating. There are so many reasons that someone might just say, wake up in the morning and say, I don't really love what I'm doing anymore. I'm just not energized. I'm not as passionate as I once was. I feel maybe my health is starting to slip a little bit. And there's other factors that are coming to play. I just don't have the energy. I'm not as sharp as I once was. Countless reasons that we might feel like we're starting to burn out and that it's just the right time to pass the baton to somebody else who's got that energy and that vision and that enthusiasm to build the business. And then the final thing is, this is the one that we would all aspire to, is too good to refuse, an offer you can't refuse, to cite a famous gangster movie. Sometimes someone comes along and says, I need to own your business and I'm going to give you life-changing money to buy the company. And you may have no reason to sell. You may have no desire to sell. But when those dollar signs pop up in front of you, you realize that that might be a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And even though none of these other things are necessarily coming into play, sometimes offers are too good to refuse, and you just decide now's the time to take the plunge. Any questions about any of these factors before I move on? Do any of these resonate with all of you more than others? Are there any additions to the list that any of you would like to make?
Well, sometimes it can be contractual, perhaps, and I can share a bit later on that. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Pete. Anyone else have thoughts? Okay, so let's dive forward and just talk about the how to prepare. And then that is going to dovetail over to the personal side, which again, I think is where we can really open things up. Here are six things that, from my experience, we should all be thinking about if we ever have any aspirations for actually selling the business. And a lot of these things should start today, even if you're looking to sell 5 years from now or longer. We should always, in a way, think about ourselves as in a position of, okay, what if I needed to sell tomorrow? What would I need to do to maximize value for the business? The first thing is to document growth opportunities. And hopefully you can all see this all right, and it's not too pixelated, but to document growth opportunities. When it comes time to sell the business and you're going to be speaking to buyers of that business, you want to make it very clear to them what that path is for them to be able to grow value going forward. And keep a journal of these ideas that you have in terms of, oh, I could expand internationally, or I could introduce a new module, or I could do ABC or XYZ, whatever it may be. Keep a journal of those ideas, because there will come a time when you're speaking with buyers or investors where you're going to say, you know, I never ran after this because limited time and limited money, but if I were coming into this with unlimited pockets of capital, here's what I would do. And paint the vision for them in terms of where things can go. And I'm not saying that you want to go to them when you do decide to sell with a laundry list of things that you would want to do, but just be ready, because that really is the difference between a mediocre sale or no sale at all and getting an investor so jazzed and excited that they're going to come forward with an aggressive offer. So in your mind, start thinking about that story, that narrative that you want to communicate to your buyers or your investors earlier, as early as you possibly can, and start to bake that and let that ruminate. The second thing is financials. Regardless of where we are around the world, regardless of the accounting rules that we're following, et cetera, I think we want to make certain that when the time comes to sell, we don't need to spend 6 months cleaning up 10 years of financial statements, because those buyers and those investors are going to come in. And if there's a lot of work that needs to be done to clean things up, you're going to undermine their level of interest. You want to make certain that you've got those numbers clean and ready to go in a way that those that will be easily digestible by those buyers and by those investors. So don't wait until the last minute. And unfortunately, there are times in life where things just come up. We may not be planning to sell, but maybe there's a health emergency or what have you that requires us to do it quite quickly, and we don't have time to play catch up on the financials. So I'm not going to go into details on the financials, but I think that you want to make sure that you're keeping clean books or cleaning up your books as early as you possibly can. And that does lead to the next one, which is valuation analysis. Now, depending on where you are in the world, there's going to be different approaches. There's going to be different types of folks who would do this sort of work for you. It might be your accountant. It might be your financial planner. It might be a broker or an investment banker you may be working with. But the more you can get a sense for where you think your business should be valued, the better positioned you're going to be to have those initial conversations with buyers and investors. Here's the warning that I want to communicate, though. Depending on who the person is who's running that valuation for you, which is just telling you how much your business is going to be worth if you decide to go and sell it, just keep in mind the biases and the agendas that those folks may have. So for instance, here in the US, if you're going to sell your company, a lot of people will hire a business broker or a lower middle market investment banker or an investment banker to sell the business. They want your business. They want to get signed up to sell your business. And as a result, they might be inclined or motivated or incented to tell you your business is worth more than what it's really going to be worth when you take it to market. So if you do engage somebody to tell you how much your business is worth, really try to understand what their motivation is. And if they're trying to sell you to hire them, recognize that you should probably haircut whatever number it is that they put forward. And I can't tell you the number of times I've seen in my career deals not happen because bad expectations were set when that initial valuation work was done. It can really kill things at the 11th hour. You don't want that to happen. But I do think getting a sense for what your business is worth is something that absolutely is valuable to you. And frankly, even if you're not going to go sell right now, it still could be kind of interesting. So there might be other times where you just want to do evaluation just for the sake of it. The next one, organize your records. And this is different than cleaning up your financials, although they're somewhat related and connected. Organizing your records, some of you, if you've ever been through down this road before, there's something called a data room. And effectively, when people sell their business, all of your documents, your corporate records, your client contracts, all of that information will be put into a file structure, effectively, that will then be shared with those buyers and with those investors. What you don't want to have happen, similar to cleaning up your financials now, you don't want that to be a rush job. And I can tell you, even in the context of the deal that I did recently, getting all of the invoices, the historical invoices that I needed for diligence purposes, was kind of hard because this company has been around for a long time. There's a lot of information there and their file structure was kind of all over the place. So what you want to do is you want to make it as easy as possible, be it the financials or those records, for your buyer or for your investors to understand, to be able to find the information that they're looking for. You don't want to make it difficult on them. So do think earlier rather than later about making sure that your records are organized in the right way. And I apologize, by the way, I'm getting a ton of notifications. I should have muted. Give me one second here. Okay, perfect. I'm so sorry. Estate and tax planning is another thing that's important. And again, you're all scattered around the world. I'm giving no advice on anything like this, but just recognize, again, you don't want to be focusing on those sorts of issues at the last minute. And sometimes we're put into a position where we have to sell on a timeline that we wouldn't necessarily choose ourselves. So just think about making certain that you're speaking to your financial advisors in advance. Hey, when the day comes for me to sell the business, is everything in good shape? Get in front of it early. You just don't want the stress and anxiety of having to navigate those sorts of things at the last minute. The last one is the great way for us to segue now. And I'm going to shut down my screen share, but are you ready? And this one, folks, I think is a really important thing to be thinking about. Let me just switch back to my main view here. A really important thing to be thinking about, which is this. And I say this with some emotion because, again, I try to anticipate what I'm going to be like the day this happens. When you make the decision to sell your company, there's a lot of things that start to go on between the ears. And on one hand, there's excitement because maybe I'm tired of running the business and I'm looking forward to playing golf all the time. On the other hand, there might be excitement because the dollars and cents are big and they're compelling. But I will also tell you that I have seen countless examples in my career of people having real challenges navigating the sale process and the day after the sale process, despite the fact that they've now got a much more healthy figure in their bank account. Because in many cases, as would I'm sure be the case with all of us, I've been running my own company now for 11 years. Well, a lot of folks, it's 20 years or 30 years or 40 years. And when you wake up the day after that deal And maybe the headache of the champagne from the celebration starts to subside a little bit. What do you do now? Now what? I'm going to the golf course. I can't wait. Great. I'm going to go surfing. Great. These are all fantastic. For a week, 2 weeks, a month, 3 months. But then you bump into somebody from your business at the grocery store. And then you start to hear, oh, the buyer's doing this, or the buyer's doing that, or the buyer changed the logo, or the buyer did XYZ. And you realize you kind of miss it. And you're getting a little bit bored surfing every day or riding your bike every day or whatever it may be. Now, let me be crystal clear. This is not the case for everybody. There are some people who are thrilled to move on to that next chapter. They've now got the financial resources to do it comfortably, and they will not look back. It is nothing but green fields ahead of them. And I pray that that's going to be me someday. But I will tell you that there's a lot of people who have a lot of difficulty making the adjustment, seeing their business change, seeing their baby repainted, whatever it may be, can be really hard. And I will tell you, from my perspective, I'm always really dialed into that when I'm speaking with sellers about the real motivations. Because the one thing I will tell you is a lot of deals die at the 11th hour when that seller wakes up that morning before closing and says, I don't know that I'm ready for this. And it happens. And by the way, at that point in time, in many cases, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars have been spent to get the transaction to that point. And somebody gets cold feet. Happens all the time. And I can't tell you that I blame people, because I don't. And I can't tell you that I'm not going to be one of those people who at the 11th hour gets cold feet too. So what I would just urge each of you to think about is, why is it something that I'm going to consider doing? Is there a role for me to play going forward? Because often there's a transition period, and often there will be opportunity for you to be involved in the business. And I will tell you this, on day one, that sounds really, really good. Because you're still, you've now de-risked, but you're still involved and you still have influence and people are still speaking with you, et cetera. But ultimately recognize that a lot of the time, those transitions actually end up being pretty difficult. Because remember, now you're still involved, but you don't really have power. You don't really have decision-making authority. People don't engage with you the same way that they used to, because you're no longer the top dog on the pyramid. And that also can create a lot of emotional or psychological challenges that you need to navigate. So I will tell you, I've seen this often where buyers will have a very regimented transition period for the sellers because of that. And there's a lot of different dynamics that will certainly come into play. So I would just urge each of you, as you think through what your longer term plan is going to be, why you want to sell, who ultimately is the kind of buyer you want to sell to, and what are you going to do the day after? And are you certain that you're looking forward to the day after the way that you actually are? Because remember, I mentioned the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars of transaction expenses. Some of those have come out of your pocket too. And you don't want to go down that path if you're not really ready to jump in the pool, or whatever the expression may be. So there's a lot of soul searching that needs to happen, because transactions are hard. The outcome is uncertain. And I don't know the percentage these days, but the percentage of transactions where you put the for sale sign in the grass and they don't get to closing because either there aren't buyers, the markets change, there's a disagreement during diligence, whatever it may be, there's a billion reasons that deals die. So putting the for sale sign in the grass, you also have to realize it doesn't mean you're going to actually get the sale done. I would say the majority of small deals do not get done. But it's a tremendous emotional burden, not to mention financial burden, operational burden that gets put on you to navigate that process. Only start walking down that fairway if you really want to do something. It's really important. It's a big investment you're going to make otherwise, with a very challenging outcome. So with that, we've got half an hour and I'd love to open it up a little bit. And Pete, I don't know how you want me to facilitate or what you think the right approach may be, but I'm happy to dive deeper on any of the topics that I've just brought up.
We're only a small group, so I think you can just speak up if you want to. Yeah, and Laurent, you just put your hand up, so why don't you go, mate?
Thank you very, very much, Steve, for this overview on the soft part of soft, on the non-number part of an M&A or an exit, and I really appreciate it because it's you have colored it with the core of our activity, which is addressing mainly HR issue or personal issues. Could you elaborate in our business, learning and development, what we do in end-to-end, and I've not been there for many years, but our business is still growing in news. Could you elaborate on the benchmark and comparable currently after the COVID and with the hype in the COVID and down again of the companies in our field? It's something which I'm really, really interested to hear from you. If you have any data, recent data, multiple of EBITDA, multiple of sales, or any other valuation criteria that could be relevant for us to make a good number.
Laurent, great questions, and thank you for that. And I am not armed with specific data. As I said in the very beginning, I wanted to try to remain somewhat detached from the more wonky investment banker side of my brain. So I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, the median in 2022 thus far has been 9.2 times, because I'll also tell you now I'm playing in a different world than I used to play in when I was dealing with much larger transactions. And many of our clients on the Peloton RPM side, by the way, are big private equity firms and big financial buyers. So they're still very active in the space and they could comment on where the larger market multiples have gone. That's not my space anymore. I'm really focused on the small SMBs, the small, medium-sized businesses, where there's a pretty big valuation disconnect between a tiny company and one that's doing $10 million, $20 million, $100 million or euros of cash flow. What I would tell you across the board is this. The markets are, and again, I want to do this in plain English. The markets have, in many respects, seized up. A lot of the buyers I've been dealing with are not super busy right now for larger platform acquisitions, be it L&D or other sectors. A lot of that is being driven by the complete evaporation of financing. At least here in the US, I'm going to speak to the US, the lending market has kind of shut down on lots of levels, regardless of the kinds of debt being used to finance these transactions. And bottom line is, if you can't find the debt, you can't really do the deal for most of these financial buyers. These are not folks who are just stroking 100% equity checks to fund an acquisition. Now, at the smaller end of the market, what I can tell you is I haven't seen a lot of multiple compressions so far, which is interesting. And again, when I say small, I'm talking $1 million and below of cash flow. That's the part of the market I'm referring to. I think that, interestingly enough, for those smaller businesses, put aside the super high-flying e-learning companies or super technology AI, where the multiples are almost irrelevant. It's just all funny money. But what I would tell you is, from my experience, once you get to $1 million and below of earnings, of EBITDA, whatever, however you want to define it, the multiples never really ran up the same way that you saw for larger deal sizes. And so even though financing has gotten tight, as opposed to the valuation multiples coming down, the capital structure has changed. The way those deals are being funded has changed. So for instance, maybe there was a time for $1 million cash flow deal where you were paying 8 times for that business. I'm pulling that out of the air, but let's say you're paying 8 times. And of that 8 times, maybe 4 to 5 of that multiple, $4 to $5 million in this case, would be some sort of bank debt maybe it's SBA debt, maybe however the lend, the debt is being put into place. And then there'd be a small seller note, and there'd be some sort of an earnout rollover. And then there would be the equity from the buyer. What I'm seeing now is the bank piece is starting to shrink in certain cases quite a bit. And what that means is if the valuation is going to stay the same, which they are, the seller is financing more of that deal through seller paper. So I wouldn't necessarily think of it as, okay, valuations are really plummeting. I would look at it and say the structure of that purchase is changing because there's less bank debt available. So not as specific as you would like in terms of multiples, because again, in my space, we're not talking about huge multiples, but hopefully that gives you an idea. Adina, yes.
Thank you very much, Steve. Very interesting. I can help, Laurent. If you look, I put it in the chat. A client of mine is trying to sell his business. They are retiring. I'm going to share screens as well so you can see. This is a company, Plimsoll, that amongst other things, they pull together data for training companies and coaching. I'm not sure whether it's only UK. It could be. But basically, they give you an idea about how they evaluate, how you compare. And my client is featured in here because they put their data in. I think it's a membership thing. Okay. So take a look and see. And their reports are really interesting because they're telling you where is it going, how many times the EBITDA is paid for, and so this is the most concrete on our industry that I could find in terms of benchmarks.
You said it's in our industry, that's the specificity?
It's in coaching, executive leadership. These are the businesses.
Uh-huh. I didn't know it exists. Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
The one thing I would say as well, Adina and Laurent, is we call it the country club effect. And here's what I mean by that. Often sellers, after they sell their business, they'll be grabbing beers at the country club with all of their buddies, talking about the deal that they just did. And there's two things that they like to talk about. Number one is that they sold to a private equity firm. Who's the private equity firm they sold to? And there's a whole hierarchy. If you sold to this firm in this top tier, then there's a halo effect that you would brag about. But the second thing is also multiples and valuation. A lot of people will say, oh, I sold my business for 14 times and I sold it to this great private equity firm, et cetera, which is the headline number is correct. They sold for 14 times. We'll assume that there's no exaggeration, but of the 14 times that they sold for, how much did they have to roll into the deal? Number one, how much is utterly contingent upon 2026 financial results that they're never going to see? Always be a little cautious about the multiples and the reported headline numbers, whether they're publicly disclosed or whether they speak to them, because deals can be structured in such a way that it makes it look like it's a much bigger number than it actually is. There's a lot of shenanigans that go on. Yes, Pete.
What was it about Watershed that was attractive to you? You know, if you just bought this company, you know, part of this question came from me thinking about, you know, in most of our organizations, there's a founder, there's a name that usually came across with the business, et cetera. And those of us exiting, sometimes that can be a hurdle or not, I'm not sure. But, you know, what was it about Watershed that you said, hey, okay, well, I can take this from the original founder and I can make it happen again, you know, do more with it. Yeah, just tell us a little bit about that.
Hey, Kurt, it's a great question, Pete. And and I do want to be somewhat careful, obviously, in terms of what I say and in terms of the dialogue that I had with the sellers, but I'm going to not say this in a negative way because there really isn't negative. The first, second, and third thing that I liked about the business were the two founders. And having now been through the entire transaction with them, doing transition work with them, there was just a connection and a trust that I had right from the beginning. And I know it sounds a little bit not finance to talk about it this way, but it's true. I just connected with them, and I was less concerned about shenanigans going on and things being misrepresented. And I closed the deal, and 2 days later, we lose our top three clients. And I just had a personal comfort there that has been worth its weight in gold. They're wonderful people, and I'm just excited to be having a connection with them, first of all. The second of all, I would say is, and this sounds a little silly, but I think this gets to your point, Pete, which is they hadn't written a book. What do I mean by that? The company wasn't so closely connected to one person who was widely recognized for subject matter expertise. There's a lot of subject matter expertise and there's a lot of IP, but it wasn't a celebrity type dynamic. And I like the fact it was called Watershed as opposed to Wood Eby & Co. or whatever it may be, where it was named after the founders, because the brand was more at the company level than at the individual level. So I love that too. The third thing is 25 years of history and some incredibly deep and longstanding customer relationships. And the fourth piece I would say is coming into this business, given what I've done for a living and the fact we're doing negotiations training, I wasn't incredibly concerned that I was going to come in and mess things up. I wasn't concerned that I would have a credibility issue with our existing clients and customers because I've been negotiating almost all my life. And so I'm delivering some capability, given my background, that I wouldn't be delivering if I was buying a healthcare training company or pick your vertical. So it was just a good personal fit as well. But full circle to the beginning, you got to really like and connect with those sellers, because having a good relationship with them is critically important during a transition. Relationships matter. They really do, a lot. It's about dollars and cents, of course, but your chances of success are going to be turbocharged if you just genuinely like the people you're dealing with, which I did and I do. Yes, Adina.
I would have thought that, you know, one of the things that you put into the package for our type of businesses is how you work yourself out of the business long before you get ready to sell it, because that's an impediment. If the business depends on you, it's a bit more difficult to sell it. So if you can say a little bit of what your situation is with Watershed, are they still with you? Is it a transition? What happened?
Yeah, so they're still with us. We've got a transition period. And the way it works, the way we structure our deal is up to a year, they can be involved in transition. So they are still involved. But I will tell you, I'm trying not to involve them as much as possible. Again, not because I dislike them or I want them to be gone, but because part of the commitment that I made to them was I want them to be able to do what they want to do with their life. And the more I'm calling on them to ask, oh, how do you deal with this client? How do you deal with that client? The less able they're going to be to go and paint and cook and do all these things that they want to do. So part of it is my personal commitment to them. But to your point about how do you manage a transition and how do you make your business saleable, you do have to make certain that it's clear to somebody that unless they want to, they're not buying a job. They're buying a business. They're buying a company that is going to be something that you have the ability to manage, not necessarily 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but manage maybe on a part-time basis, or you put a general manager in place. You want to start to institutionalize your business or your practice in a way that will show people that the ability to scale is real. Doesn't mean you have to be able to show a roadmap to a $100 million business or $1 billion business, but you want them to know that with the right investments, the business can be institutionalized and can 3X, let's say, over the next however many years from where it is today. That to me is the most important part. And I will tell you in diligence, it's funny. One of the things that I was told is take a look at, everyone checks social media these days, obviously. And if you're thinking about selling your business, be aware of the fact that buyers are going to check you out on social media. And interestingly enough, if there's a whole bunch of pictures of you on vacation, that's a good thing. Because they realize that you spending time in the south of France or you spending time in Thailand means that the business is still running and humming without you being buried in it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so I like the fact that the owners of Watershed had a life, because it showed that there was more to it than just them being locked to their desk 24 hours a day to make it successful. So show those holiday pics. It does make a difference. Yes, Pete.
Hopefully Adina and I don't dominate this too much, but just, you said earlier that it's quite common for the sellers to finance the sale. In other words, you know, they wait to get paid out. Is it common in that circumstance that the sellers actually stay in the business until they're paid out, or do they hang on the sides, or, you know, what's your experience there?
I'm going to speak from a US perspective here, because that's obviously my immediate personal experience. So in the US, there's SBA financing, where a lot of the small deals that get done, the SBA, the government basically guarantees on some level those loans on behalf of the banks who are lending the money. And the SBA has a whole bunch of different rules in terms of how involved those founders can be, because the whole mandate of the SBA in terms of providing this service, is that they're facilitating a transition. They're facilitating a change of ownership. And so they don't want to see a founder who's still working in the business 3 years later, because that isn't accomplishing their mission. And so generally speaking, if it's an SBA-backed deal, there's a period of time, 12 months, that a founder has to be fully transitioned out of the business, whether they're financing that deal or not. If it's a bigger deal, if it's a more traditional private equity deal, this is an important thing to understand, is that often, going back to what I mentioned earlier to Laurent, maybe they sell for 14 times, but they're rolling over 40%, let's say, of their stake into the new company. You're selling your company, but you're not really selling your company. You still have a lot of skin in the game, and you do not necessarily have control over how that company is being run. So it is a risk for that founder. That capital is certainly at risk for them, and they may not have a lot of influence over the outcome.
Thanks. Who else has got questions?
Yes, what? Clive.
Yeah, well, not so much a question as a comment, actually, that kind of agrees with what you're saying there, I guess. I mean, when I go back 25 years before I started my business, which ran until 2 years ago, I worked as a consultant with a big consultancy practice. We got involved in various M&A activity, and I'd go in sometimes as a interim finance director after a company had been taken over. And one deal I was involved in on that basis had gone so badly wrong from the point of view of the buyout clause that the buyer had put in place, that the seller actually went after the buyer with a shotgun. So wow. he was so offended by how badly he was treated that he left one day, because he was still working in the business, but he was being marginalized, and his buyout share was going to become increasingly worthless. So he had to be kept from the premises when he turned back up with the shotgun. So it can be a very emotive thing. So actually, when I was involved in negotiating to sell my business 2.5-3 years ago, I was very, very shy of any sort of a buyout arrangement, for sure.
Yeah. How was the experience for you, Clive, from a personal perspective? How did you feel the day after, and the week after, or the month after?
Well, therein lies a story. The negotiation process took about 6 months and was due to conclude on about the 10th of March 2020. A week before that, COVID hit, and my order book disappeared in the space of 10 days. I mean, literally disappeared entirely. And understandably, and I would have done exactly the same, the buyer pulled out.
Okay.
So I went through quite a lot of an emotional roller coaster, shall we say. So, but it was an interesting process from an academic perspective, and all the things you were saying there about having the financials ready and having the organized records and all of that good stuff, and making sure that you've got a business that could be run independently of the owner was really important. And fortunately, in that respect, I made a decision a few years previously that I would work a maximum of 4 days a week and 40 weeks a year, and was able to point very, very quickly to the buyer and say, actually, this business, I know it runs without me because I'm not here most of the time. So yeah. Actually being able to do that is actually really important. So yeah, I agree with that point as well.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that the deal didn't work out. And as I had said earlier as well, we just right up. The expression I'd like to use is there's never a good day in market. Once you've decided, and by the way, this applies to selling a home as well. Being here in California, I know in the times where we've put our house up for sale, the second that for sale sign goes in the grass, I just think we have to get this done as quickly as possible because there's going to be an earthquake. I mean, you always just assume like the worst case scenario. Once you've made the commitment to go, run as fast as you can, because only bad things tend to happen in the market when you're in market, and hesitation can really end up costing. In this case, there was no way to anticipate COVID, but that's exactly the point. Whoever could have guessed that would have happened the way that it did? But,
no, you're right. And the interesting thing was, Steve, the buyer wasn't in any particular hurry, but he wasn't trying to drag his feet either. The only reason the deal had taken the final 2 months that it had taken was he happened, fortunately for him, I guess, he happened to have a really incompetent lawyer.
And
so it just happened that the thing was due to finish early January. It kind of got pushed out and pushed out and pushed out. I'd had a drop dead date because I was going away skiing for a month, and I wanted the whole deal done before that. So that was, we'd agreed the final drop dead date, but it should have happened December, early January, but these things happen.
Five, that's another great point. There are so many, this conversation could go on for hours and hours. The advisors and the importance of having advisors around you who you trust and who have interests who are aligned with your own. If you're going to have someone advise you on a deal, and I'll specifically focus on lawyers, having a commercial lawyer, and when I say commercial, what I mean is an M&A attorney, someone who's worked on transactions before, but someone who is commercially minded, who isn't going to get so caught up in the competitive negotiation dynamic with opposing counsel that they're more focused on winning their own battles than they are winning your battle, which is to sell the company. And I've been very lucky to have an attorney who I consider one of the closest advisors I've ever had in my life. He's not looking to make a few more hours off of me. He just wants to get the deal done. And he's not going to do it in a way that's going to short circuit or force me to incur more risk than I should. He's going to protect my interests. But he also realizes the goal is commercial. The goal is business, to get the deal done, and everything he can do within the constraints of good lawyering, he's going to do to make sure that we get to that outcome. So exactly, Clive, you just mentioned what can happen if you've got a lawyer who isn't focused on the target like that.
It's true, yeah. It doesn't sound like your guy's a proper lawyer.
I'm sorry?
It doesn't sound like your guy's a proper lawyer.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He's amazing. It's funny, a friend of mine from high school introduced me to him originally. And I remember my friend saying, next to his father, this guy is the senior most important advisor he's had in his life, beyond even his wife. And I remember commenting about that. And he's like, I'm just saying it as it is. I consider my wife a closer advisor, but he's pretty darn close. He's amazing. Very lucky. Rob, sorry, you were about to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, as a recovering M&A lawyer, you're absolutely right.
Where did you practice? Where'd you work?
I was in Chicago at a mid-sized firm called Holub & Koff. I retired from the law about 15 years ago. So
nice. But, assuming you have not looked back.
And then went in-house and bought and sold. I went in-house and bought and sold companies for a few years. And it's
Sorry, Rob.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm done. See, I'm recovering now. So.
Well, Rob, I'd love to catch up with you. Obviously, we'd love to catch up with all of you separately at some point. But Rob, I'm sure we've got some overlap and shared stories that we could be telling. And hopefully what you've heard from me today is consistent with the experience you've had as an M&A attorney as well.
Well, I was going to say thank you. Yes, I've been in the L&D space for a while now, and it's nice to get reminded of the personal side of it. Everything that you said has had great resonance.
I appreciate it. This experience with Watershed has been tremendously fulfilling from a personal perspective. When I've been involved in deals in the past, much larger transactions, they're very transactional, they're very clinical. When you're dealing with a small, tiny business like this, you're seeing the impact you're having on the lives of people. And It's really fulfilling. It really is. It makes me very happy to see.
I'm going to say the most fulfilling thing I did as a lawyer is bought a company for someone and sold it for him 5 years later for 10x.
Oh, fantastic.
And he was a great guy. It's just like, it's the best.
Life-changing.
Yep. For a really good person.
Yep. I love that. Absolutely love that. So I know we got about 5 minutes left and I do have the hard stop. Other thoughts or questions that I can address for folks? And Pete, any thoughts as we wrap up?
Hey, Pete, can I jump in? I came in late, yeah, so sure. I've already covered this. Just say, yeah, sorry you got stuck in traffic and that's the end of it. But, I'm curious because we're talking about small businesses and, I'm working with somebody, on the West Coast who's involved in educational businesses. And I always have this question of if I had a business I wanted to sell, should I contact the people who I consider potential buyers, or should I hire a lawyer or some sort of consultant to make that initial contact for me? So I don't know if you covered this or not, but that is the question I had in my head when I saw that you were going to be here.
You heard my heavy sigh, Kurt. It is a classic, timeless question, and Rob certainly can attest to this as well in terms of how best to handle this dynamic. The problem, there's clearly benefits to going direct. You may have known these people for 20 years, these potential buyers. You've got a great personal relationship with them, and that could be wonderful, but that can also undermine your cause. The whole good cop, bad cop thing. Having a good advisor in place can send a message to the other side that this is a competitive process, that value matters, that they need to be responsive, and that frankly, they can't in any way, shape, or form potentially take advantage, deliberately or otherwise, of that 25-year relationship. Having an agent of some sort serving on your behalf can be tremendously beneficial. Logistically, it can be tremendously beneficial because there's a lot of work that needs to get done to facilitate a deal. You've got a day job, you're running a business, there's a lot of different priorities you have. This can be all consuming. So much so, I will tell you, I know buyers who have had a strategy in the past of overwhelming sellers with so much in terms of diligence requests that it makes it really difficult for management to keep their eye on the ball. So financial results slip a little bit. And then the buyer comes back and says, I'm cutting the price by 15% because you missed your numbers. There's a lot of games that can go on that you want to protect yourself to, but protect yourself from. But I'll leave you with this point. The benefit of having someone representing you is that almost inevitably at the 11th hour, if not later, something's going to happen. Something's going to go sideways. Someone's going to say something that gets everybody else worked up. A wire's not going to cross. Some information's going to come in that is negative. There's always, without any exception, going to be some drama. And the benefit of a good advisor is being an honest broker and shepherding people through that blocker. And it can be really difficult to do, even if you're negotiating with a buddy. Sometimes you need that third party to smack your heads together and say, get past it. You both need to get this deal done. You got 24 hours to figure this out. And a good broker can help you do that.
Perfect. That's what I was hoping you would say. So thank you very much.
But make sure that they're trusted and respected by both sides. That's a key thing too. You just want to make sure you have the right people around you.
Yeah.
Okay, Steve. Perfect. Brilliant. What I'm reminded of, you asked about final thoughts, like just listening to all this, I'm reminded of the talent and the resources in this community. I mean, I didn't even know, you know, some of the things going on with some of the people here today, and I know them pretty well. So I think that's just amazing. I think we should reach out to each other when and if we need that kind of help. But of course, to close it off, Steve, thank you so much for hosting us today. That was enlightening, opened up a lot of questions. But I think, as you said, if anyone wants to follow up or explore it, they could possibly even get in touch with you or me or each other. You know, we can talk about it with each other too. So everyone, a little bit of a round of applause for Steve. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you, everybody. I'm thrilled to be part of this. I really am. Thank you, Pete, for the opportunity. Nice to meet everybody virtually, and looking forward to staying in touch and being part of the network going forward.
Beautiful. Thanks again.
Thanks, Steve. Terrific.
Thank you. Thanks, Steve.